Hello, and welcome back to A Life Economy, dedicated to exploring the intersection of technology, spirituality, and consciousness. I'm Cosmos Scharf, and on today's episode, we are joined by Robin Arnault. Robin is the co-founder of Andromeda Entertainment, as well as SoundSelf, a really fascinating and trippy VR experience that morphs the colors and shapes and visuals to the sound of your voice, creating an experience that effectively dissolves your sense of identity. And I'm just so grateful to have him on the show today. Enjoy our conversation with Robin Arnault.
I'm a video game designer, and so I see craft and the tools of the world that I have available to me, I see in terms of video game design, systems design. And specifically, when I think about video games, it's an interactive system that you immerse yourself in, and as you are immersed yourself in it, it changes you. You play a theatrical role in it. So SoundSelf is a video game, but instead of drawing its inspiration from video games in the past and more or less the history and etymology of video games as we think of them, it draws all of its inspiration from transformative experiences and like meditation and ceremony. So it's this technology that uses all the power of a video game, but it's not about scoring points or anything. It's really all about getting in touch with yourself. And it's been very instructive to me. This is a metaphor I use all the time. It's not really a metaphor. It's just that a meditation, for example, is a game. It's a game you're playing. It has rules. A breath meditation, for example, the rule is you bring your attention back to your breath when you notice it's deviated, and that's it. And a simple set of rules like that can create a profound set of changes to your consciousness. Now, that's true of video games as well. Simple and complex as much as simple sets of rules can create simple shifts, can create incredible shifts to your consciousness. Complex sets of rules can likewise do that. And that's what a video game is. It engages the architecture of our consciousness in an experience and transforms how we experience the world in that moment. Usually by sort of elevating our cortisol and giving us a sense of investment in a drama. But there's absolutely no reason and nothing inherent in the format of video games that has to limit us to that scope of psycho-emotional responses. So SoundSelf, I guess I'll just describe it. It draws inspiration most of all from chanting meditation. So you play SoundSelf by breathing in, then long tones out, like that. You just do that again and again, and the whole world responds to your voice and dances with your voice. It starts at the base of a tree. Oh, go on.
As you're describing it, I'll play some visuals so people can have a sense of what it is that we're looking at.
Well, if you have it, go ahead, and we can start at the base of a tree, and you're guided into a meditation up the tree, and soon the whole universe opens up into just this psychedelic abstract geometry that's intimately responding to your voice. And what we find is that people who play this you lose a sense of being a self after maybe 5 minutes, 8 minutes of play. You know, you're conscious of yourself as vocalizing and using your voice to, quote, control the experience for maybe the first 3 minutes of play. And then after about 5 minutes of play, generally people have an experience of you're not controlling your voice anymore. You're following your voice. Your voice is there, but you're following it. And that's maybe a hard experience to imagine unless you had experiences like that before. But then after maybe 8 minutes, it's very common for people to completely lose a sense of their self altogether, which is what this experience was designed to do.
Right. So what we're looking at right now is SoundSelf, which is some very pretty, trippy, colorful, abstract movement of colors and form. How did you come to design what we're seeing right now on the screen? How does it actually work?
Well, I had the inspiration came to me from my first oneness experience, and I realized that I had everything I needed to provide oneness experiences for other people, minus, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years of work, but that's just required the work. And so there were certain pillars of design that were established very early on. And each of them I've had to slay as a sacred calf in certain aspects of the game design. But the conversation with those pillars of design have been core to what SoundSelf is. And one of those pillars is abstraction. Because if you're playing a video game, your mind is always looking for some detail that it can hook onto and create meaning around and create mastery around. Because that's just what your mind does. And so by creating this constantly shifting and moving abstraction, your mind cannot do that. And so it has to give up. And giving up is the core of surrender. You actually can't surrender without giving up. You can pretend you're surrendering, but this is a system that actually requires and invokes a kind of surrender of your meaning making functions.
Very cool. What I love in particular about your product, or I don't know, that product is a bit crude, but you know, your game, or what you refer to as a technodelic, which is a really interesting phrase, is how you're leveraging game engines for a purpose that is surprising and not really something that we've seen before. You know, when we think of what you can do with something like Unity or Unreal Engine, we're used to first-person shooters or platformers, but certainly a meditative experience that gives you an experience of oneness is something that very few other titles on Steam can be found.
Yeah, well, I think one of the patterns you're noticing there, I'll tell you a few patterns that I think are so ubiquitous across gaming that we don't even think about them as being ubiquitous, but they define the whole medium. And they unnecessarily contract the whole medium around these ubiquitous assumptions. So one of them is avatars. You always have an avatar that you're controlling.
Right.
And that avatar is, you can have a silly kind of avatar. Even in VR, you know, you're always playing VR as a being that is roughly human. Even if it's kind of fantastically not human, it's still a binocular visioned being that is in a corporeal form. So you always have some kind of simulated corporeal form or forms that you are controlling, and that become the vehicles for your sense of agency and expression within the game world. Now, obviously, when you're playing a game, you're not just controlling that avatar. You're actually controlling the entire experience. Mm-hmm. You're controlling the camera. You're controlling the way the enemies respond to you. You're controlling the environments. You know, all of it is actually under your control. It's just that the structure of the video game and the avatar draws your attention towards a very, very specific mode of being within that space that it leverages and reinforces our sense of what we are, which is not a problem. It's just like, sure, that's what all video games do. And you could say, well, like, that's what almost all art does. And fair enough. I think you'd be hard pressed to find a novel that doesn't make use of the literary version of an avatar. But it's worth noticing because it's not necessary. And, well, can you make a video game in which you are not a human or humanoid being? Yes, but you have to, as a designer, not invoke the humanness and the self-referentialness and the corporeal separate self in the design. The design can't reference a self. And one of the ways that a self is constantly referenced through an avatar is through that avatar's relationship with an environment and with enemies, for example. Okay, so that's you. Go on. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, it's fascinating to consider the relationship that video games portray with this sense of self, with identity, and the way that you totally flip that on its head in Sound Self. And was that always part of the conception of Sound Self?
Yes.
Or was that something that emerged over time?
Yes, it's always been central. It's always been central to it. It's really amazing, like having a blast of inspiration, just how much of what makes the experience what it is preserved from that blast of inspiration. So an incredible amount of information came to me all at once. And the years of work on it have been really about realizing that information and finding the ways where it needs to kind of compromise or adjust in order to meet human psychology where it is. Which is like honestly what the last 3 years of development were, because I had this, you know, crazy psychedelic weird experience that if you could get into it would blast you off, but most people would most of the time be kind of resistant to it at first because it's very strange. And so it took a long time to design, honestly stepping away from those original principles to kind of create a wrapper for the experience to help people sink into it and open their hearts to it. So
and how did you do that?
That was, so when you open the game, you start with, so I'll bring you to, I mentioned that one of the principles of Sound Self, one of the pillars of design is that it's abstract. And you'll notice first thing when you come into the game, you're at the bottom of a tree. Well, that's not very abstract, and you're underneath a starry sky, and you hear crickets. These things aren't abstract, but they're really necessary to ground you in a sense of something so that something can gradually dissolve. Now that was never a part of the original sort of vision, but it was a, and in fact, in some ways, it runs against some of the principles of the original vision. But exactly those deviations from, or not deviations, I'd say the things that are antithetical to that original vision are exactly necessary in order to make the whole experience more accessible and powerful. Which is just an interesting, I think, part of the creative process is, you know, thesis, which you can describe as that blast of inspiration. Antithesis, which you can describe as like meeting the reality of human psychology over playtests and so on. And then synthesis, which is what happens when you bring it all together into something that integrates all of it. I could keep going and describing some of the other aspects of video games if you like that I think are ubiquitous.
Sure, yes, please.
The one that I think is super important to recognize, because I think this is going to change in the next 5 or 6 years, is that our interaction with computer games, video games, are binary. We use our fingers. And our fingers are an extension of our sense of agency in our mind. But there's so much going on in our body that doesn't even really talk to the mind. You know, your heartbeat, your breath, and the temperature of your skin. There's a tremendous amount of intelligence going on that is not mental intelligence. And so, but the whole paradigm of video games reinforces mind every step of the way because you're using your fingers. So once you break free from that and recognize, oh, I could have a video game that whose systems interface with your heart, then you actually invoke a whole different set of emotions and responses in the game world than are possible with just, say, fingers. It's completely different.
That's really fascinating.
And begins to resemble like a psychedelic ritual more.
Yeah, so I'm reminded... Go ahead.
Yeah, I think as we get more biosensors into gaming devices, it's going to open up a radical new portal for game design. We're not quite there yet, but it's coming. It's coming down the pipe. My only hope is to educate designers in the meantime so that they don't use these incredible rich bio information to like treat it like a button, treat it like a finger. You know, like can you get your heartbeat up to this thing to make this thing happen? Like that's right. That would be the wrong place to take that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. What you're saying about how video games are structured around, or rather they're reinforcing the mind as the main mode of intelligence that we're exercising. And yet there are so many other domains of intelligence within our being that the video games are not able to interact with because the technology is just not really commercially available or presented to us?
I think this speaks to actually the whole technological paradigm right now. And I think we're in a place right now, not only technologically, but across the whole spectrum of psychological experience, where we're realizing that we need to surrender our minds, and that our minds are not, you know, the sort of king and creator of everything that's going on here. We're culturally learning to identify with our minds less, and as that happens, I think across the board, you can feel into it right now, or maybe your listeners can. I'd just like to invite everyone to, like, there is a whole universe of intelligence happening here right now. You know, your heart is beating. Your across the galaxy, there are stars that are orbiting around one another. There are little microorganisms that are evolving this moment. There are social movements that are beyond your capacity to understand and control. And your mind is only a teeny, teeny, teeny piece of what's going on. But when we surrender to the greater wisdom of the intelligence that's everywhere else in our being and in our body and in the cosmos, there's just a deeper intelligence at play. And I think we are being called to adapt our technologies and our entertainments to a real embodied reckoning with the fact that, you know, the mind isn't the only kid at the party, isn't even the coolest kid at the party.
Yes, well said. And I think it goes beyond even just our technology. I mean, we could speak perhaps more broadly about our culture, the way that our culture is optimized for enhancing and strengthening our mind. We think about, for example, like coffee.
Absolutely.
Constantly drinking coffee and caffeine, staying alert, being productive, working.
And there's not, it's worth reminding ourselves that this is not the, de facto, necessarily a function of human civilization. You know, we exist within Western civilization, and you can go, there's this great saying, you know, you really know your country once you've left it and come back. But it's while it's pretty easy to go to France and then come back to the United States, and maybe even easy to go to Thailand or something and get out of Western thought and then come back, it's a lot trickier to get out of the civilizational story and come back. But we do have within this narrative, and this is a very specific narrative that we're living out, it's in a process of regaining its spirituality, but for many years it's been pretty spirituality has been marginalized. When you look at a real healthy indigenous society, and by indigenous society, what I really mean is a really healthy society. You know, there's no reason you can't have people might fight me on this, but I'd like to ask you to hear my words and find the truth in them rather than kind of nitpick the details. There's no reason you couldn't have if you think of indigenousness as being having a relationship with the land and having a relationship with the whole body and being at peace with the cosmos rather than being at war with the cosmos, because all of our civilization right now is, I think, basically a function of a limited war with the cosmos.
Yeah.
There's no reason we can't rediscover our indigenousness. And I see our current civilization as being kind of Rome 2.0. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I think it's an evolution right now.
Yes, well said about Rome 2.0. There's a theory about how a bunch of people from Rome reincarnated into America, and that's what we're seeing, the same patterns play out here over again, which is really fascinating.
We've even got the same architecture.
Yeah, well, what you said about regaining spirituality, that seems to be, I don't know, that's on the forefront of my mind these days, about seeing what's going on in the world and what's playing out on the political stage with Black Lives Matter, with coronavirus, with our response and reaction to those movements. And from one perspective, it can seem very kind of hopeless and frustrating and just like the world is turning into a dystopian nightmare. But in another sense, we can view it as a necessary stage of part of our spiritual evolution. So I'm curious how you see, you know, what's going on in the world right now and its relationship to what you're offering people.
I see us going through a transition. And transitions are painful. And you don't necessarily survive a transition. There's no guarantee that you're going to survive it. Mm-hmm. But I do see, how best to word this. I'll put it this way. I trust it. I trust the things that are changing. I trust the changes that are afoot. And there's aspects of it that we can see that, for example, racism. And there's aspects of it that we cannot see. And we're biased towards focusing on those parts that we can see. And it's exactly like this thing with the mind. There's a greater intelligence, even just in your body, than your mind. Your mind's not the only show. What the mind does, though, is it labels things and quantifies things and learns how to maneuver things and take advantage of things. And Western civilization, I think, is an incredible experiment in how far we can take the mind.
Right.
And I think I think it's worthy of being respected, because if we can't respect it, we can't integrate it. It has to be integrated. There's no moving back. There's only moving forward. So, I actually don't want to talk about the things that we can see, because we can see the racism stuff. We can see the classism stuff. We can see the various excesses and strains on our politics and on our markets and on capitalism itself, and on our democracy as well, and the very, very, integrity of the democracy. So those are the things we can see. I'm a lot more interested in what we can't see, because as with everything else we're talking about here, I actually think there's a lot more some intelligence in everything we can't see than just in the parts we can. And more importantly, I think because our minds make sense of things oppositionally, the places where we focus on what we can see, we tend to divide ourselves into oppositional camps. And that's that. Then you get ideologies and latent hatreds. But if you... Like, the body is such an intelligent thing, and it produces things like boils and diseases, and these are intelligent responses to the environment and intelligent responses to evolution. Like, I have a 5-year-old, and every time he gets sick, and he gets a fever, and he stays in bed, and he's miserable for the night, and then he comes out the next morning, and it's like you can see the maturation and the development of his personality has taken a massive bound.
Wow.
In the night that he was sick. More so than in days when he's healthy or even engaged in like intellectual learning. But when his body gets sick, and I've heard this from countless parents, you know, when your child's body gets sick and you let the body be sick, it goes through an evolution, and it's an evolution that is larger than the mind and necessarily includes the mind. So it takes the mind to the next level. So we're really sick.
Fascinating. Yeah.
But there doesn't mean there's not intelligence in it.
Sure. Absolutely. It's really fascinating to consider this pain and trauma as elements of an upgrading process. Like what you're saying about coming out of a fever, well, it's like no fun to have a fever and to feel sick, and that's terrible, but to then come out of that being stronger and healthier is pretty powerful. The body being a technology also resonated with me. For most of my life, I have been obsessed with technology as expressed in cameras or phones or laptops, and was a real Apple nerd when I was a kid and still am. And there's something that changed for me a few years ago when I realized that the body is really the ultimate technology. It's so complex and so beautiful and powerful. And it's one of those things that's, you know, we're so used to being in a body, to experiencing this reality through this perspective, that it's sort of staring us in the face, but we don't really quite appreciate it because it's just so normal and sort of commonplace that we really take for granted.
Yeah, there's so much incredible wisdom there. Incredible right. wisdom in the body.
And what's cool is you can hack into it with
body involved in.
With meditation and breathing.
Yeah. My one of my colleagues just taught me a breath work. He called it a DMT breath, and I've been doing it in the mornings. Where, boy, is it powerful! It's like an incredible endogenous high, like a DMT high, after just 3 minutes of a very specific, not even particularly difficult kind of breathing.
Interesting.
Not even 3 minutes. It's like each session of it takes about a minute and a half. I think the change that I was about to say is coming, but I'll adjust that to say that has to come is changing the focus of our whole technological enterprise from being of mastery over the universe and mastery and compressing the universe into bits to assist us in conveniences and so on. Or, and into a relationship of humility and prostration and conversation. You know, you can build a piece of technology that is in conversation with the mystery. Mm. And that is a very different way of approaching building businesses and technologies. It requires, I think, a lot of... The words that come to me is grief and heartbreak, because there's this myth that we are always living out in the creation of our technologies and our businesses and our politics and so on, which is the myth of mastery, the myth of coming out on top. And in a surrendered relationship with nature and the cosmos, there's, you know, times you're on top and times you're on bottom, and all we can do is really humble ourselves. And I think there's a lot of, I don't know why this word came to me, but it really came to me. It's like the important thing that's missing from our relationship with what we're building is grief. That makes sense to me because there's, I think there's an arrogance in the way that we approach our technologies, especially our medical technologies. God, such an arrogance. But can you create a technology that approaches the mystery humbly? I think we've done an expression of that with SoundSelf. You know, SoundSelf is all about approaching the mystery. And not only is the experience itself designed to help a person kind of prostrate themselves before the mystery and come into contact with silence, but it was designed in a real surrendered relationship with mystery. I wonder what happens when we design not just entertainment pieces from that place, but also all sorts of technologies and our politics from that place.
Absolutely. What's fascinating about SoundSelf is it's not just a game, but it's offering a vision, a different vision of what technology can be, one that's more connected to spirituality, to a new sense of identity, and other forms of intelligence.
Yeah. I think that other forms of intelligence thing is crucial. We believe we're alone. And that belief creates itself. And as we believe we're alone, we isolate ourselves not only from our spirit companions and our plant and animal companions, but also our human companions. because they're a different color to us or because they're a different politics to us.
Right. Yeah. This belief in separation is one of the, I believe, the fundamental root issues that needs to be looked at and addressed, which is, yeah, it's like you say we believe that we're alone, but it's interesting to really understand and explore that belief. Like, where does that come from? I'm curious to get your perspective on that, if you've ever considered sort of the underlying aspects of that idea.
I've thought about that a lot. And what I always think about when I think about that is, again, my 5-year-old stepson. And gosh, it's so amazing watching a child grow. And because, again, there's such an intelligence behind it that no parent could ever design and no technologist could ever design. There's a genius to the development of the child's psychology that is so humbling. But there's a stage of a very frustrating stage of child development that, you know, goes by the label primary narcissism, which is this stage where, you know, you're 2 years old, 3 years old, other people do not exist to you. They are there to serve you. And so you are narcissistic. You are fundamentally narcissistic at that stage. And that is developmentally appropriate. I've seen from that, so with my 5-year-old, is I've seen him come out of the narcissism of his threes and because of the way he really expressed himself through that and met the world in it, he actually has a really strong sense of self right now, which today expresses in compassion and a sense of confidence in his ability to make an impact and agency and boundaries. You know, so many kids grow up not knowing boundaries because their primary narcissism is kind of shut down in their childhood and not accepted. So there's some learning at play. I think that we humans are children in the larger spiritual context. And I think we're on a journey that, and I suspect there's something from our belief in our aloneness that, that is important, not only for us, but for the greater world. As part of the journey, I don't know exactly what that is, but I really do have faith that there's an intelligence to all of it at play, and that that we move through that intelligence more gracefully when we humble ourselves to it, which means also looking at aspects of the world that look ugly. Like, here are some that are really thematically present right now: greed, racism, autocracy, control, disease. When we assume that these things have a place, which doesn't mean that we should not oppose them necessarily, right. But having faith in that process that there's something here that belongs, which might include your resistance to it.
Mm-hmm. Right. This concept of
developmentally. And that might sound like a bypass, but it.
So man, this lag going, is killing me.
That might sound like a bypass, but it doesn't. Yeah, totally. It may sound like a bypass, but it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that you have to take a passive stance or anything. It just means that, like, that humility can bring you into a deeper sovereignty. And a deeper surrender, both at the same time. I don't know where the fuck all this is coming from right now. This is not how I usually am in podcast interviews. This is all just coming through me right now.
No, that's awesome. So this idea of developmentally appropriate, that phrase stood out to me because, you know, when we look out the world and we see what's going on, and I, you know, sometimes I get frustrated and I feel a little hopeless about the state of humans and the state of politics and the environment. And I'm like, oh man, is this really the best we've got? Like, this is not looking good. But what you're offering, the perspective that you're describing, is seeing that really as a stage that we're moving through that is a necessary part of our evolution. Would that be accurate?
Yeah. And more so, even more so, you look at stages of human psychological development, it's not a steady curve. It is always you have plateaus and then you have climbs, and then you have plateaus and then you have climbs. And so, just like my story with my 5-year-old and having a fever and then waking up the next morning suddenly more intelligent and compassionate, when he didn't gradually become more intelligent and compassionate, it happened through the fever. And we also see that happen at these, you know, other life stages, like I don't know how familiar you are with integral psychology, but I found that as an interesting starting place for some of these explorations. But so with that in mind, we spend most of our time in a plateau. And that happens individually on an individual level. And we have developmental shifts that happen well into our adulthood, you know, like your midlife crisis, if you have one, is a developmental shift. But it's also these moments of having a fever. These transitional moments are, they're not easy. And that's exactly where we are right now. I'm grateful, so grateful to be a part of it, to witness it, you know? And I hope, I would really love if I could invite all of your listeners into one thing. It's gratitude for the difficulty, knowing that it doesn't have to be permanent. Hold on just a second.
Sure.
That's not quite it. It's more just like the transition and the pain of the transition is so important developmentally. And we're not going through this individually. We are going through it collectively. There is a collective transformation happening right now. And there's a developmental shift happening that, like, a 3-year-old doesn't know what it's like to be a 5-year-old, can't know what it's like to be a 5-year-old. You could describe to someone in primary narcissism as much as you like what it's like to care about other people, and they're not going to get it because it doesn't fit into their paradigm. And so we can't get what we're turning into. We can't think we can wrap our head around. So here's what it doesn't look like. It doesn't look like the socialist dream for a beautiful world, or the social justice dream for a beautiful world, or on the other side of things, it doesn't look like the libertarian dream. It doesn't look like anything that we're capable of dreaming right now. But we are in transition.
So if you had to guess or take a stab at what it could look like in terms of what we're meant to embody or behave and show up, and how we're meant to show up for each other, I understand what you're saying is that, like, we are not able to completely embody it because we're not through that transition yet, but if you're saying what it's not, which it's an interesting point, but if you had to maybe use some key words, what would that look like for the future?
So I can take a hack at that, but with the massive grain of salt that this is just one 3-year-old talking to another 3-year-old, broadcasting to a bunch of 3-year-olds about what it's like to be 5.
Right.
But nice. I'll try. I think that the things at play, letting go of this, story of separation and feeling our interconnectedness again, remembering where we come from. And with that comes, necessarily, and perhaps ironically, a deeper sense of sovereignty and a deeper sense of the truth of what we are individually. So you look politically, there's a tension. You've got one people on the one side claiming about freedom and individuality, and you have some people on the other side speaking about collective and being here for all of us, you know? But the tension is, it's the top side of a loop that connected the bottom. Because when we're in the integrity of becoming, who you are becoming, and as you attune to the world and are in relationship with being an individual, not as a self-serving sort of unit of energy, but in service, then what is good for the sovereignty of your soul and for the sovereignty of your individual is also exactly the medicine that the collective needs in that moment. I think there's a flavor of that wisdom moving through us, and I think there's a, I think we're purging a lot of the relationships with the world that are self-centering or community-centering, that are not embodying that that true sovereignty of service.
Mm.
And so the movements that I'm really interested in, that I'm tracking, that I think embody these principles most elegantly are decentralization movements and wellness movements that step away from the allopathic medical model, which is Western medicine, pharmacological interventionist medicine, and actually returning more to that wisdom model, like a re-indigenizing process that I think is happening. But that's, again, that's just, you know, 1 3-year-old telling another 3-year-old what it's like to be 5.
What I love about what you're saying is this fractal nature of evolution, where we look at the developmental process within a single person, going from a kid to being a teenager to being an adult to, you know, becoming an older person. We see that playing out in the larger scales of the collective, and that is that gives me hope for humanity in a broad sense, because now I have a new way to contextualize all the apparent chaos that we're seeing play out right now.
And you can go to my webpage and buy my product. That product will help you meditate and rest more.
That's good.
So if you're frustrated with the world like it is right now, right, go buy my product.
Yeah. Exactly. So what are some of the new things that you're up to in the world of integrating technology and spirituality and meditation?
Well, so it's not only technology and spirituality and meditation, it's business as well. To me, I'm obsessed with the idea right now of, and just with the challenges, the really interesting challenges of running a business, because a business is its own little living entity that needs to eat, needs sugar, money, and it's a really beautiful thing that comes alive. And it's like being in business means you, and having to look at the balance sheet and keep the company alive, especially when you're doing something bold and new like we're doing, which doesn't have any existing economic models. We have to. It's a real humble surrender process, and I love it. So to me, the mission right now is, yes, to build out these technologies of well-being, but also to build out the business infrastructure to make that sustainable, so that not only this company but other companies can exist in an economic ecosystem with one another that can support the creation of transformative experiences and delivering those experiences through existing infrastructure channels, like you mentioned earlier, Steam, Oculus, and so on, but also through new infrastructure channels that don't exist yet. So right now we're looking at building, not looking at, we are building a pod, which is this, you know, beautiful thing you climb into with a vibrating floor where you can experience transformative content, and we'll be selling those to wellness centers. And then the idea is to use those as a, I just get obsessed with the economics of it all, is using those as a way to help ease clients back into wellness centers when they're not used to coming to the wellness centers again. So using this product that we're working on building to help wellness centers come back into business after the coronavirus pandemic is easing off a little bit. So this is probably not like as sexy to talk about as like the spiritual design of someone, but I think it's super critical. Is what do the business infrastructures of creating these look like? And they have to be sustainable business infrastructures. Otherwise, they're not going to survive in the highly competitive economy. So, man, I'm paying a lot of attention just to smart business movers and shakers.
Excellent. Yeah, you bring up a really excellent point about integrating spirituality, more of a spiritual principle into business. And that's something that's been on my mind as well. You know, having experience building several companies over the last 5-6 years and now looking towards potentially doing something new and looking at how I can create a business entity that really is, of course, not only financially sustainable, right? Because that's number one important thing to keep the business alive, but to give back to the environment, to be in harmony with the environment, as well as our employees, and just look to optimize not just money, but health and well-being. And I'm looking at, for example, Holacracy as a way of organizing a company, and B Corps and other alternative funding models, and just sort of starting out on this research project of looking how to do companies in a new way. And it's an interesting time for this right now. Oh, cool. Tell me about it. How's that going?
Yeah. I love Holacracy. We've been running it since the birth of our company. And I can't imagine running a startup any other way, because I have things I love doing that I'm good at, and I have things I hate doing that I'm not good at. And there is a ruthlessness to the typical corporate structure that isn't well suited, I think, to most individuals. And what Holacracy does is it is such an organic living system that allows the whole structure of the company and our obligations to one another to evolve extremely organically. It's an amazing practice, and I think it's such a transformative practice. I would love to see it get picked up more.
And how does it work in practice? Like, what are some of the components or the details of it that make you such a big fan?
I'll describe Holacracy briefly for your listeners who may not be familiar with it. But if you want to talk to Brian Robertson, who's the founder of Holacracy, I think you'd have a great conversation with him, and I'm happy to put you two in touch.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The way it works, so if you think of a typical corporate structure, is you have a like a CEO at the top who has people who report to him, usually him, underneath him. Then you have people, like, that's middle management. And then you have people reporting to them. And so the skills that are sort of high-value skills are managerial. And the skills that are relatively low-value are they're creative or they're something like that. And so what Holacracy does is it disrupts that whole system and replaces the hierarchy with what you would call a heterarchy. So it's not non-hierarchical, but instead of these predefined roles, you have a number of roles that you create organically as you feel the need for a role to come up. And each role has relationships to other roles and obligations to other roles and things that they control. And but the thing is, it's super organic. So, let's try like hiring and firing people, which the person who's your CEO might not be good at or might not like to do, or strategy, or any number of like very high level important things for a business that typically the higher level important things for the business fall on the waist or the on the lap of the CEO, and the low level less important or more tactical things or more creative things fall on the people down the chain. A heterarchy, which is, you know, you have roles who have a network of relationships with one another, means that it, like in my company, there's some ways where my opinion is the opinion that matters because I embody the role that gets to invoke that. And in other ways, there are roles where my opinion just doesn't matter. And I can pitch that person on something and try to convince them of something, but ultimately it's up to them. And this, like, ultimately it's up to you, you know, ultimately it's up to one person, I think really gets past, a serious issue that is endemic in the anti-hierarchical structures, because it's like, oh, we can't have one person in charge, so let's make everyone in charge, but then nothing gets done. So instead you create a sort of network of exclusive or non-exclusive authorities.
Mm.
And then you have this evolutionary process for figuring out what needs to change in that network. It's extremely powerful. It's extremely effective. It works fast, and it turns conflict and tension not into this thing that's uncomfortable that, like, maybe you should avoid, or maybe you should just learn to get good at, or maybe you should learn to politic. It turns all of that into just grist for the mill for making better relationships between different roles. So amazing practice. I love it. And I can only speak very highly of it.
That's really awesome, and really appreciate you sharing your perspective on this. That's something that I've been looking into and considering how it might work for projects that I'm working on in the future. And it feels like I'm pretty confident that is the model that we'll be using. So it's excellent to hear someone that has what sounds like years of experiencing practicing it.
I literally can't. I would not work. It's hard for me to imagine myself working for a company that is not practicing a hierarchical system like that.
Right. And that phrase hierarchical, actually, I've never heard of that before. That's really neat. And the phrase that comes up is decentralized. Is that accurate, or
is decentralized.
Okay, cool.
So this is actually just one of the things. I'll go ahead and just say that seems to be changing a lot right now. You know, like, what's on the other side of this? Like, you look at so let's go back to this tension between individualism over here, which like expresses itself in its most kind of toxic expression as this like fuck you, I'll say what I want. And you look at there's so much violence that you can pin to that I think people are really seeing right now. But then on the other hand, there's this collectivism violence, which is like you have to say it like this, otherwise shut up. And anyway, you look at how those two forces play out in business. And what it looks like is, on the one hand, there's the hierarchical sort of corporate systems that we're used to. That there's a lot of rightful and reasonable criticism over right now. And then the opposite to that, you have like a pro workers movement or something like that, which is talking about unions and talking about like disassembling capitalism, disassembling, like ousting people from high positions of power. And there's just generally kind of a hatred in any kind of centralized authority or power. But again, it's the same thing. I think the thing on the other side is actually, like, look, down at the bottom of the circle, they're connected. And what you have there is sovereignty. And so there are ways that you can structure a corporate entity or any business or any kind of entity that invokes sovereignty and surrender. And then you just get better decision makings. And without imagining, it's like either the individual matters or the collective matters. No, like a healthy relationship with the individual is one that really nourishes service. And a healthy relationship with the collective only comes from respecting individuals.
I love what you're saying about balancing the individual and the collective, and that being the paradigm that we're moving into.
No, it's not a balance.
Okay.
It's not a balance. I really want to emphasize that it is not a balance, because a balance leads to you thinking like you have to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you get from that is basically is something kind of like what we have right now. It's a transcendence of both of those.
Mm.
It's a transcendence of the limited thinking of the individual and the limited thinking of the collectivist into a synthesis.
Right.
Not a compromise.
So perhaps more of an integration. Would that be more accurate?
Yeah, I think so. As one three-year-old to another.
Right. What is funny about... One of the things that I'm pulling out from what you're saying is that when we can move into something like holacracy, it actually is a more effective way of running a business where everyone feels like their voice is heard. Whereas a traditional hierarchical organizational structure where a handful of people are in power and they're clinging on to that power because it makes them, you know, it gives them some sense of control over their reality. You know, it's just funny that there are alternate ways of doing things that might not necessarily be obvious, but once we start doing them, we realize how silly the old way of doing things once was.
And there's so much that's changing right now. It's so humbling to witness it.
Absolutely. So let's wrap up here. Is there any last words you have for our friends listening that you want to share, either about SoundSelf or about what's going on in the world or anything? Any last words?
I'd really love to just direct people to the SoundSelf page and to try it out. It's I can't guarantee it's going to make you sovereign in your but it is a meditation experience, you know, and I think so much of what's necessary is for us to slow down and meditate and get in touch with our bodies and surrender and let go of our minds. Like, so much of the world right now, you look at social media, and social media is a platform that is just, it's all mind and it's all mental chatter and it's all conflict. It's so tragic. So please get off social media and get into meditation. And if you want to experience what a technological invocation of that looks like, please go to our website and try it out. And it's like, I feel like I can bring that up shamelessly right now after a conversation about these sort of transcendent
sure, things, sure.
Because we're trying something new here, and I think that if you want to feed these new things and try new things out, this is the way to do it, is to get out of the comfort zone and try something new out. So please actually do go to SoundSelf, try it out.
Yes,
and if you're inspired by that, inspired by this way of thinking about things technologically, just I'd love to hear about them, and let's get the conversation moving on to what's new. What are the new ways that we can be approaching these things, and out of the old conflict of like us versus them, which is just like this old idea versus this old idea. Leave it behind. Like, let's create something new.
Wonderful. Yeah, SoundSelf is definitely a unique and enjoyable, relaxing experience that I've had the pleasure of trying before. And thank you, Robin, for joining us here on A Life Economy. This has been a really fascinating conversation. Really enjoyed it. And blessings to you and everyone listening. And hope everyone is staying safe and healthy and having a wonderful rest of your week.